All right, now we are in the middle of syncing the letters of the Apostle Paul with the narrative, the historical narrative of the book of Acts. And let me just review where we have got so far. The first journey the Apostle Paul made from Antioch in the company of Barnabas began in the island of Cyprus and then crossed the sea to the north and into the central highlands of what is now Turkey, which was then the Roman province of Galatia, Pisidian, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. Those towns each visited twice, once going through and the other turning around and coming back. And then back to Antioch, very important, a very large and important city in the Roman world in those days. So understandably, a center of Christian evangelism and missionary enterprise. In the interval between the first journey and the second, the Judaizing party, those Jews who were convinced that in order to be a Christian, a Gentile must become a Jew, the Judaizing party had begun to rise and exercise an unholy influence in the church. That was what prompted the first synod, which is recorded for us in Acts chapter 15, which concluded that that was not the case. Gentiles did not have to become Jews in order to become Christians. Circumcision was not mandated for them, and so on. That means almost certainly that the letter to the Galatians had to have been written before the synod, because the synod addressed that question so directly that had the synod already occurred, Galatians would have reference to the judgment of the elders and the apostles as we have it in Acts 15. So Galatians is the first of Paul's letter, written in between the first and the second missionary journey. The second journey began again through those same Galatian cities and then on into Europe, and those towns in what is today northern Greece, Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica, and then going south to Athens and to Corinth, where he was to stay for a considerable period of time, 18 months or so. The Thessalonian letters seem to have been written from Corinth, and so not very long after Paul had been in Thessalonica and had established the church there. So 1st and 2nd Thessalonians are letters 2 and 3 of the 13 of the Apostle Paul. As we pointed out last time, there are some obiter dicta in the Thessalonian letters that suggest that they were written from Achaia, that part of Greece, and written relatively shortly after Paul had left the new believers in Thessalonica. So he returns to Antioch after that second journey. The third journey begins again with a tour through those original Galatian cities. They're the ones who get the Apostle Paul's personal attention three separate times, according to Acts. And then he goes to what would be the eastern, or actually the eastern shore of the Aegean Sea, the western shore of what is modern-day Turkey, to the city of Ephesus, where he was to remain upwards of 3 years. And it is from Ephesus that he writes, because he has been given a report of the troubles in Corinth, he writes the letter we have as 1 Corinthians. And he tells the Corinthians how to resolve the problems that have been dividing the body there. But so central to his interest is Corinth, an extraordinarily important Greco-Roman city in the time, and so worried is he by the developments that he has addressed in his letter, but does not yet know how they have been worked out. He sends Titus from Corinth to Ephesus to Corinth to survey the situation and bring him back a report. But he's so eager to know the results of Titus's trip that he Unable to wait any longer, he crosses the northern tip of the Aegean Sea into Greece and happens to meet Titus coming back toward him and toward Corinth. He gives Paul a very positive report, and that report produces 2 Corinthians. So 1 and 2 Corinthians are letters 4 and 5 of the 13. He sends 2 Corinthians south to Corinth, and then rather slowly follows those letters and spends 3 of the winter months in Corinth, because you cannot travel by sea during the winter in those days. And it is from Corinth that he writes his letter to the Romans. That's letter number 6 of the 13. He returns from this third journey. By the way, the second journey covered probably about 2,500 miles and about 2.5 years. The third journey may very well have been most of 5 years in length. So he's been away for quite a long time, especially from the mother church in Jerusalem. So he intends to go back to Jerusalem. Remember, on that third journey, he's not only collecting an offering for the poor in Jerusalem, a way of cementing the bond between Jewish and Gentile believers, which is so significant to his whole effort, but also bringing representatives from those churches. Luke is one of them, so that the Jewish believers in Jerusalem may actually get to lay eyes on some of these Gentile Christians that they've been hearing so much about. So he returns to Jerusalem, is there arrested, spends 2 years incarcerated in Caesarea as his trial wends its way slowly through the courts. Apparently, speedy legal processes were no more likely in those days than they are today. And during that time, as we pointed out, Luke, a highly educated and obviously intellectually curious individual, does all the research necessary to write his gospel and the first part of the book of Acts. All of that material in chapters 1 through 12 regarding Peter and his ministry and so on, he would have learned that from eyewitnesses of it, perhaps Peter himself, during that 2-year period when he was, as it were, stuck in Palestine. Remember, fearing that the governor is going to hand him over to the Jewish authorities simply to curry their favor, he appeals to Rome, which is his right as a Roman citizen. And so even though he learns later on that he probably would have been acquitted by the governor, he's on his way to Rome. Luke accompanies him, several others do as well. And Acts ends, as you remember in chapter 28, not only with the riveting story in 27 and 28 of the shipwreck and his adventurous journey from Caesarea to Rome, but with Paul under house arrest, obviously free to bring people into his home to hear him preach and teach. And during that period of time, a period of at least 2 years, because that's the time mentioned at the end of Acts, he writes the 4 so-called prison epistles. That would be Philippians and Ephesians and Colossians and Philemon in no particular order. We don't have any way of knowing which was the first one to be written and sent and so on. Those letters would be 7, 8, 9, and 10 in the order of the 13. Again, those 4 in no particular chronological order. It's almost certain that Paul's missionary travels then recommenced after he was released from house arrest in Rome. If you read the end of Acts, it obviously appears that the threat of punishment has waned significantly. Whoever is in charge of his case in Rome is going to have received a report from the governor in in Judea, saying basically the guy hasn't done anything that requires our intervention. Roman officials, generally speaking, kept out of internecine squabbles between religious communities in the Roman world. It was part of their strategy not to provoke by inserting themselves into matters that were precious to some of the conquered people, but were utterly matters of indifference to the Roman authorities. So Paul had told the Romans in chapter 15 of his letter that he was hoping to go to Spain, and there is some evidence in the materials of early Christianity that he actually did so. Then he had some other ministry in the Mediterranean basin, to which reference is made in the pastoral letters, which would all three have been written after his release following Acts 28, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, the last of them being 2nd Timothy, when he's again under arrest in Rome, and now in this particular occasion, Nero being the emperor, he is anticipating the end of his life by execution. There are these little obiter dicta that help us figure out some of these things, these passing comments. The Apostle Paul says, Trophimus I left ill at Miletus in 2 Timothy chapter 4. But there's no way of fitting that particular remark into the narrative of Acts, which is another indication that there was continuing ministry between his first Roman imprisonment and his second. And that some of these letters were written then. So those last three letters, the pastorals as they are called, would be letters 11, 12, and 13. Again, number 12 being the last of the 13. So there are some differences of detail, little information as we actually have, but here is one calculation of the chronology of Paul's life and ministry by several highly regarded New Testament scholars. They place his conversion somewhere between 33 and 35. Now that obviously depends on the date of the Lord's crucifixion, which we said most likely is either 30 or 33. Those are the most likely dates for a Passover on a Friday in those years. Obviously, if it's 33, Paul's conversion would be somewhere in the 35 area. If it was 30, it might be 33. Then the ministry immediately following his conversion in Damascus and Arabia, that would be years 35 to 37 of the first century. Ministry in Tarsus, remember he was sent off for his own safety to his homeland in what is today southeastern Greece or southeastern Turkey. And he spent considerable time there, 37 to 45. And we wonder, Christians have always wondered, what the Lord was doing, parking the Apostle Paul, of all people, in some hinterland when the most gifted man they had should have been leading the van in the Greco-Roman world. But the Lord's ways are rarely our ways. Then the first missionary tour, 46 to 47 or 47 to 48, probably lasting about 18 months. The Jerusalem Council would have been 48 or 49. The second missionary journey, 48 or 49 to 51, he was in Corinth for 18 months, so the missionary journey itself had to have lasted at least 2 years. And then the third missionary journey, which included almost a three-year stay in Ephesus, the total time being perhaps upwards of 5 years, as I said. The Caesarean imprisonment from 57 to 59, the voyage to Rome 59 to 60, Roman imprisonment, 60 to 62, further ministry, perhaps as far as Spain, elsewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean basin, from 62 to 64, and his martyrdom in Rome in 64 or 65. Now, that chronology is based on some absolutely datable events in the Greco-Roman history of the first century, the time, for example, that Gallio was the governor of the province in which Ephesus is found, and so on. And then these small remarks here and there that Paul scatters through his letters. So the question, how are Paul's epistles to be fitted into the narrative of Paul's missionary works and travels that we have in Acts, actually can be answered with reasonable accuracy. There are, of course, some differences of opinion regarding slight amendments of that order and that chronology, but devout scholarship is largely in agreement about this. And it's interesting to me, it's actually quite important to me, that we can fit his letters into the narrative of Luke so easily, given that Luke doesn't exactly tell us when any of these things happened. He doesn't date them the way we would date them. Usually Paul gives us comparatively little information himself, and obviously in those days nobody was calculating dates the way we calculate them today. Nobody was saying this happened in April of the year 38. AD 38. But before I go on, there is a long history of skepticism regarding the origin and the dating of Paul's letters. Even in some cases, in fact, in a number of cases, confidence that Paul didn't write this letter or didn't write those letters at all. 19th century German higher criticism denied almost everything. The Gospels were supposed to have been written in the later 2nd century, which provided an adequate amount of time for legends to develop and then to be included in the narrative of the Lord's life and ministry. These were naturalists. They didn't believe in miracles, so they had to explain the literary history of the New Testament in a way that sophisticated modern people of the 19th century could understand how people could have told these stories when obviously they weren't true. And the easiest way to explain that is to say the stories weren't written down until almost 200 years after the events they purport to record had happened. The skepticism was ideological, was not evidence-based, and now, from the vantage point of all biblical scholarship, it looks genuinely preposterous. But you almost never have a liberal scholar admitting that fact. We really blew it in the 19th century. We were so committed to proving the New Testament unhistorical that we swallowed a lot of codswallop along the way. You never hear that from liberal scholarship. But the onward march of research, and it's actually a fascinating story. If there is a book that you might someday want to read just for the adventure of it, it's Bishop Neill's N-E-I-L-L, the Anglican bishop for years in India, also a real scholar, Stephen Neill. The history of the interpretation of the New Testament. It sounds dull can be, and actually it's a page turner, because this was what was going on in a way that people also almost never admit nowadays. It was the Germans against the Brits for a century. And it was the scholarship of the English and the Scots that overturned the 19th century German skepticism about the history of New Testament writings. The first and the greatest achievement was that of the English Bishop of Durham by the name of John Barber Lightfoot. There was a triumvirate of Anglican scholars in the 19th century, very loyal to the Bible. Two of them were Westcott and Hort, and even still today you hear the names Westcott and Hort all the time, because their scholarship And their production of a text of the New Testament lies beneath the text that everyone uses, all biblical scholarship uses today. The third of that triumvirate was Bishop Lightfoot. Lightfoot's tremendous achievement was to date the body of literature that has long been known as the Apostolic Fathers. These are not New Testament documents. These are writings that come after the New Testament, and in fact, they are the first body of Christian writings after the period of the New Testament itself. We're talking about the letter of Clement to the church in Rome, the seven letters of Ignatius, the bishop of Antioch, the martyrdom of Polycarp. They extend all the way to Justin Martyr's apology in the middle of the second century, but what J.B. Lightfoot demonstrated to everyone's satisfaction, when somebody changes the way everybody thinks about some very important thing, you know you have a scholar who has done yeoman service, and that's Lightfoot. He confirmed that these writings were dated from the late first century and the early years of the second century. Well, in these writings, there are references scattered all over to the writings of the New Testament as the writings of the apostles and the New Testament. So obviously, the writings to which the apostolic fathers refer have to be written before their writings, because they're making reference to them in their writings. And nobody any longer thinks that the apostolic fathers are later than the late first and the early second century. Well, that means you can't have any writings in the New Testament that aren't written in the first century themselves. J.B. Lightfoot dropped the chronology of the New Testament by a century, by his achievement. The second most important achievement was that of a Scottish classicist taught at my alma mater, Aberdeen, Sir William Ramsay. There was a tremendous tradition of classical learning in the British university. These men not only could read Latin and Greek, they could have a conversation with someone who also spoke classical Greek and first century or classical Latin. In fact, I don't know how many of you have read the memoir of Robert Murray McShane by Andrew Bonar, his close friend, a classic of Reformed spirituality. But McShane and Andrew Bonar were deputed by the Church of Scotland to make a trip to the Holy Land to see if the Church of Scotland could commence a missionary work there. It actually, the fruits of that labor can still be seen in Tiberias today. There's a big Scottish Presbyterian church in Tiberias, right on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Ian Hamilton, who was here not so long ago, spent a summer working in that church as a seminary intern. In any case, on their trip, they couldn't speak to very many people because they didn't know Aramaic, they didn't know Arabic, which most people spoke. But on their way back, they didn't go back by sea, they went back by land through Europe. And in Poland, McShane finally met somebody he could talk to. It was a Polish Roman Catholic priest, and they had a long conversation about the gospel. Not because McShane spoke Polish, or because the priest spoke English, but because they both spoke Latin. And so the conversation was in Latin, which was still, in the middle of the 19th century, the language of the European university. Well, these men knew Latin that way, and they knew the classical world that way. Ramsay began his researches in skepticism. He expected to find that Luke made a lot of elementary mistakes about the geography and the nomenclature of the Greco-Roman world of the first century, because that was changing all the time, and Luke, writing many years later, as at the time Ramsay had supposed, wouldn't know that those changes had taken place. But in fact, his researches led him to precisely the opposite conclusion, that Luke got everything right. And he not only got the big things right, he got the little things right. He got the things right that you wouldn't have expected anybody to get right, except somebody who was there and who knew what he was talking about. Those two British scholars fundamentally altered both the impression of the New Testament's authenticity as a general fact and the historical reliability of the book of Acts as a specific fact. Now, the Germans took a long time to be persuaded, and many of them have never been persuaded, but not because the evidence isn't there. The liberals have been walking back their skepticism of New Testament historicity for 200 years, but they're not all the way back to the to a recognition of the reliability of the book. And that's some proof, I think, of the ideological basis for their skepticism. They do not want the New Testament to be a reliable doctrine giving us an account of what actually happened. And so there have to be some place in the New Testament, some fakes, some pseudographs, books supposed to be written by apostles that weren't in fact written by them, and so on and so forth. Much later came J.A.T. Robinson. Robinson was an Anglican bishop, what we would call an unbelieving Anglican bishop. His sort of manifesto in the 1960s was a little book that became a British bestseller entitled Honest to God. And basically it was a denial of virtually everything that Christians have believed about both the history of the gospel and the message of the gospel. It was an overt attempt by somebody who was supposedly a Christian minister to accommodate Christianity to the zeitgeist, to the spirit of the age. And of course, the age was the 1960s. And then 20 years later, he writes a book entitled The Redating of the New Testament. And Robinson was a real scholar. He never became evangelical in his convictions, but he did argue in that book, which is referred to frequently in the New Testament literature, even today, that it is preposterous to assume that the New Testament would not directly reflect the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem had that event occurred before these books were written. That was such a climactic development. It said so much about God and the Jews, and said so much about the burgeoning church outside of Judea and apart from the temple, that it's inconceivable that the New Testament would not have made reference to that event had that event already occurred. And that's the fundamental thesis, but he goes on to develop it in some tremendous detail, as scholars do. He argues that everything in the New Testament was written before AD 70, including the book of Revelation. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case, but it was a remarkable statement at the time it was published by the person who published the book, because it was virtually the undoing of the entire edifice upon which skepticism about the New Testament had been based for 150 years. Very much like the JEDP thesis in Old Testament scholarship, the idea that the Pentateuch is made up of these various documents, some of which weren't written until much, much later, even the time of the exile, and that we can somehow or another pull these documents apart and tell which part of the Pentateuch each section comes from, J or E or P. D is Deuteronomy, so that's a separate document by itself. Almost every argument that would have been used in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, to prove J-E and J-E-D-P has now been withdrawn. But the edifice is still there. And it's very hard to imagine it disappearing overnight, because there are simply too many scholars who have invested too much in that thesis, in that concept of the literary history of the Old Testament. There would be too many people who would have to admit that too many books were just completely wrong and we're talking about something that didn't actually exist. In fact, there are two tremendously significant streams of Old Testament scholarship at work today. One is the sort of the dying, usually older community of Old Testament scholars who still have an investment in that long-standing theory about the literary history of the Old Testament. And then there are these scholars who have been a part of the literary revolution in Old Testament studies, and they are not talking to one another, they are not writing about one another, because one of them is the contradiction of the other. And now you have these two lines of scholarship moving forward, and one or the other of them cannot, both of them cannot be right. And it's a fascinating personal and sort of human story about biblical scholarship. Then finally came, only a few years ago, Richard Bauckham's magisterial book entitled Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And if you've not read Bauckham, most of you, I think, would find it a fascinating read. Bauckham is a mildly evangelical scholar, British Anglican evangelical. B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M. Richard. And the book is so significant, this does not happen very often. The book is so significant that it has now come out in a hardbound, enlarged second edition. Only books that really get a lot of attention are publishers willing to publish a second time, on the assumption that there are a lot of people who've already bought the first edition and they're not going to spend money to buy the same book a second time. And the last thing they're going to do is put it in hard binding, which makes the book even more expensive. And yet that's been done for Bauckham's book. And it's a very detailed and very technical argument, but what Bauckham demonstrates is that on every page of the New Testament, there is the assumption of, or the actual assertion of, the fact that lying beneath what is being said is eyewitness testimony. Everywhere, eyewitness testimony in the New Testament. Now, we know that. The Apostle Paul rests everything on the fact that the Bible's historical assertions can be believed. If Christ be not raised, we are of all people the most to be pitied. Nevertheless, that is a hill to die on for liberal scholarship. If they give that up, they give up the store. So you can understand why not everybody is falling down on their knees and saying to Richard Bauckham, what must I do to be saved? But I want to say a little bit about that, because this is the world in which we live. Your kids, if they take a religion class at a university, this is what they're going to hear. In regard to the letters of Paul in particular, there is now no longer any doubt about some of them, particularly what has been called, since the Germans began to dominate New Testament scholarship in the 19th century, the Hauptbriefe, the chief or the principal letters of the Apostle Paul. There are four of them. Anybody want to guess what the four Hauptbriefe are? Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and Galatians. And I don't know of anybody of any stature in New Testament scholarship who denies that the Apostle Paul wrote Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and Galatians. They, as it were, are the effulgence of the person and personality of the Apostle Paul. It would be impossible to explain them in any other way, and it would be impossible to explain their influence only if they had come from the pen of the Apostle Paul. Similarly, there are very, very few who would ever doubt that 1st and 2nd Thessalonians were written by the Apostle Paul, or that Philippians was written by the Apostle Paul. There are doubts about Colossians, more doubts about Ephesians. As you know, the whole little phrase, to the Ephesians, is missing in some of the early manuscripts of the New Testament. And the theory is, in many cases, that it was a circular letter. It just happened to go to the Ephesians first, or the copy that got preserved was the copy that had been sent to the Ephesians, but it went to other places as well. Nobody knows for sure. But the real skepticism concerns the pastorals, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. There are lots of people in biblical scholarship who deny that Paul wrote the pastorals. The vocabulary is supposed to be different, as you would expect, a letter to a ministerial colleague rather than to a church. The church in the pastorals is supposed to have reached a state of organization beyond anything that could have been expected at that time, the late 50s, the early 60s. And so on, all of these arguments have been eviscerated. The study of vocabulary and so on. Now with computers and with databases, you can do things scholars just simply could not have done a generation or two ago. You can compare one Greek writer earlier work to his later work and make all sorts of calculations about the percentage of difference between his vocabulary as a 35-year-old and his vocabulary as a 55-year-old and so on. All that kind of work is being done all the time. And the arguments have never been very impressive, certainly not to devout scholarship. And if you're thinking about a letter that, as it were, reflects in profound ways the personality of the Apostle Paul, those letters certainly could be said to do that. But I wanted to mention two people you've probably heard of. Bart Ehrman is professor of religion at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Elaine Pagels is a scholar of early Christianity at Princeton. Very important to your understanding of their life and work is that both of them were evangelicals when they were young. Both of them rejected understanding of reality. Bart Ehrman has spent much of his professional career trying to teach his students not to be evangelical Christians, as he once was. He studied at Moody, then at Wheaton. He's a competent scholar when he's writing in the Guild, for the Guild, in professional New Testament scholarship. He's a gadfly when he's writing his popular books, and they don't betray the same careful scholarship. Nothing in Bart Ehrman is anything you need to worry about. And then Elaine Pagels, as you may know, Probably the second most important archaeological discovery after the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found in Israel, what was then Palestine, right down near the Dead Sea, in that very, very dry climate where parchment scrolls would be preserved. Even drier is Egypt, and there was a treasure trove of documents that were dug up at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, and they are known as the Gnostic writings today. They come from the later part of the 2nd century, the later 100s, and the 3rd century into the 200s. You've heard of some of them, the Gospel of Thomas, for example. And Pagels is arguing that those are different but equally valid expressions of Christianity. And basically it was the white Western males who chose what we think of as Orthodox Christianity as the version that was going to be the true and authentic version of our Christian faith. Again, this is not something you should take at all seriously. Here is, not exactly word for word, but very close. Here is the last verse of the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. By the way, the Gnostic Gospels have no narrative. They're all sayings. There's nothing in there about the crucifixion and resurrection of the Lord, because, of course, that was a huge scandal to Gnosticism with its denial of the physical world and its treatment of the physical world as the source of all evil and of all human suffering. You wanted to escape the physical into the spiritual, and the resurrection of the body did not fit into the Gnostic worldview at all. But other things didn't either. Here's the last verse of the Gospel of Thomas. Peter said to the Lord, "Make Mary go away, for she is a woman and not worthy of life." Jesus said to him, "No, we will make her a man so that she can be worthy of life." Which is odd for a Princeton feminist by the name of Elaine Pagels to wrap herself around the Gnostic gospel. But her life's work is to be able, if she can, to combine Christianity and Buddhism. Those are her two favorite ideas, Christianity and Buddhism, two worldviews that literally cannot be combined. They are the fundamental contradiction of one another. But this is the sort of thing that happens in biblical scholarship, and you may wonder why, but the fact of the matter is every human being cares about the meaning of life, and scholars do too as human beings. And if you're unwilling to believe in God and Jesus Christ and the narrative you find in the New Testament, you've got to believe in something else. And so they do. Now, just before we end and give some time for questions, a word or two, by the way, the accommodation of the Christian message, the gospel, with the Greco-Roman philosophical worldview, which is what Gnosticism was. It was an effort to accommodate the message of the gospel to the zeitgeist, to the philosophical world in which people lived in the Greco-Roman world of the first century and second. That's a problem we've been having ever since. So the idea that there should have come such things as the Gnostic gospel shouldn't surprise any of us. People have been trying to accommodate the gospel to their particular worldview as long as there has been a gospel. And Tatian, the Syrian Christian who wrote his Diatessaron through the four, he knew there were four gospels. already in the middle of the second century. He knew what those Gospels were, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and attempted to combine them in what we would call today a harmony of the Gospels, so to tell one single integrated story of the Lord's ministry. Finally, a word on the order of Paul's letters. The pastorals are last, so that could suggest that there was some sense of chronology in the ordering of the 13 letters of the Apostle Paul. But if chronology really mattered, 2 Timothy should have been the last of the 13. It should have been 1 Timothy, Titus, and then 2 Timothy, because clearly 2 Timothy is at the end of Paul's life. Galatians is the first letter in the order, but it's the fourth in the list. Romans and 1 and 2 Corinthians are the longest of Paul's letters, considerably the longest of Paul's letters. And like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, which are by far the longest of the prophets of the Old Testament, it appears that they were put first because they were longer. We talk about the major prophets and the minor prophets, and all we mean by that is the longer prophets and the shorter prophets. And the longer ones come first and the shorter ones come next, not least because you could get all 12 of the minor prophets on one scroll. You didn't need more than one scroll. But Isaiah could fit on a scroll barely, and the same with Jeremiah and with Ezekiel. And that apparently seems to be have something to do with the organization of Paul's letters, the long ones first, the short ones last. And the shortest one, interestingly, is the very last, which is his letter to Philemon. The letters that are written at the time of Paul's first arrest and his house arrest in Rome, the so-called prison epistles, they're grouped together. But Galatians is right next to them, and it has nothing to do with those letters. So the simple fact is nobody knows where this order came from, and nobody knows by what principle, for sure at least, by what principle they were put in the order they are. They're the same in the Roman Catholic Bible, the Orthodox Bible, and the Protestant Bible. There are some smaller Eastern sects that have slightly different order, or have the letters in a slightly different order. But generally speaking, that's the universal order. Question over here?
Oh, well, Connie took that approach soon after we got married. She organized all my books in descending heights. It took years before I could find
them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much what Elaine Pagels has been trying to do, so you may want to watch that. All right, that's everything on the letters of the Apostle Paul. We're going to talk a little bit next time about what you find in those letters, the theology of Paul. He's such a significant figure, so defining for our understanding of the Christian faith, that I thought that would be significant to say something about that before we go on. But any comments or questions on all of this material, Paul's letters 1 to 13? Okay, thanks very much.